Hi, this is Dave. I play piano sometimes at Olive Garden. Don't really know why I'm here. But you're listening to Juicebox Music Podcast. Hello and welcome to Juicebox Music Podcast. I'm your host, Hunter McClamrock, and on the line, slipping into his maraschino red cherry dress that he bought for $8.99 at Goodwill, it's Nick Moreau.
What's up? Yeah, I'm wearing it. It was a steal. It was a steal.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
So we're here. We got three albums to review for you guys this week, as well as a little rundown of a few topics we've been following in the news. I think we'll start off with talking about the Icelandic composer Jóhann Jóhannsson, who unfortunately passed away earlier this week. Were you familiar with his work at all, Nick?
Mostly his soundtrack work. He did a lot of soundtracks for Denis Villeneuve's recent films, Sicario and Arrival.
And Prisoners, and I believe.
Oh, did he do Prisoners as well?
Yeah, he did Prisoners.
And I always thought Sicario and Arrival had amazing soundtracks. I think he was nominated for Sicario, actually.
That sounds right.
And I know he was coined to do the Blade Runner one and then was removed from the project.
What I understand, he did compose the score for Blade Runner 2049, but they decided to scrap it last minute and use a Hans Zimmer score. Mm. Funnily enough, the same thing happened with the most recent Darren Aronofsky movie, Mother. He also composed a full score for that movie, which was never used.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. But, you know, going back to him, you know, I thought that work was excellent. I have to say I love Denis Villeneuve, so, you know, anything associated with him to me is always kind of regarded as pretty good. I think it's really sad. I really wanted to dive into his solo work. I think it sounds interesting, a little daunting.
Yeah, it looks like he put out about 10 solo albums, right? Aside from his soundtrack work.
And it seems like, from what I've read, they're fairly dense as well, kind of experimental. But there's a couple that I'm already interested in jumping in. I think his latest was Orfei. And I'm interested in checking that out and kind of, you know, it's sad that discovering almost his solo work in Postmortem, but I am interested in checking it out. It's so young.
I think a lot of people will probably be looking into his solo work because of this recent news, but it might have been something that was daunting or that you put off. You thought he would be around for a lot longer creating a lot more work. Yeah. I noticed he was nominated for an Oscar for Sicario as well as The Theory of Everything, which he won a Golden Globe for. Yeah,
that's right. He did that. Yeah. I'm very sad.
So yeah, cause of death unknown. I don't know. I don't know anything about the man personally, but especially with those films you're talking about, his soundtrack work was really memorable. And I was a little disappointed, as much as I like Hans Zimmer, to hear that. I was anticipating the Blade Runner movie so much and was disappointed when I learned that his score would not be used. I wonder if any of that score or the score of Mother will surface in light of this recent news.
I hope so. There's another, you know, I was reading this morning also that he did work with a filmmaker called Panos Cosmatos. I think he's a Greek filmmaker who done a movie that I really liked called Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Oh, yeah.
And so I guess he had done recent work with him because I'd seen Panos Cosmatos tweeting about Jóhann Jóhannsson's death. And then recently I just saw Flying Lotus mentioning that the work they'd done was incredible and very influential on some of the work he's doing and possibly on Kuso. So,
yeah, there's a film due out this year called Mandy, directed by him. Yeah, and starring Nicolas Cage. It looks completely bonkers.
Yeah, and so that's the work that I guess he did with Panos Cosmatos that I guess was very influential to Flyo's recent work.
is interesting. I saw a few tweets from Flying Lotus, and I was wondering what that connection was. Yes, too soon, very, very soon. But I think it looks like he's got about three more films that he's scored that will come out in the next year. So at least there's something to look forward to there.
Yeah.
And then other news stories. One thing that caught my attention, the story about The National scoring a Cyrano de Bergerac opera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that sound interesting at all to you?
I guess so. I mean, are we going to be able to hear it without seeing the play?
Debuting at the Terrace Theater in Connecticut over the summer, featuring music from Aaron and Bryce Dessner, the guitar-playing brothers in The National, and then lyrics from Matt Berenger, the vocalist, and his wife, who he's been writing lyrics with over the past, a couple albums now from The National. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing some of it will be released. A lot of times these like rock artists who go into this kind of field, they'll put out an album of it, especially even if the work isn't seen very widely. Something kind of like some of Damon Albarn's operas come to mind, Dr. D and the one about the Monkey Kingdom. I forget what that's called, yeah. But they both somehow like eventually saw the light of day as, as scores from the opera. But I don't know. I don't know if this has the possibility of, I guess it just depends on how successful it is in this first run. You would think this summer that, probably the score has been completed, I would guess, even though this news is just being released now.
It's true. I'm curious to listen to it. I hope there's a release, but I also hope that it makes sense without the context of the play. But I guess it's a pretty famous work, so should be able to get the context.
I mean, to be honest, most of my knowledge of this story is from like the late 80s Steve Martin movie, Roxanne, which I think is a telling of the same story.
Not from the Gérard Depardieu rendition?
I'm pretty sure I saw that too when I was a kid, but I remember Roxanne more. That was probably on TV a lot more.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
But one of the Dessner brothers has put out, I think, a few albums. I believe it's Bryce school compositions. So this isn't completely out of left field for them at all.
And I think they'd done other stuff like that. Like, didn't they do a song for like a video game, Portal 2?
Yeah,
2 years ago.
And don't act like you don't know that game.
Well, I never played it. So
you didn't?
No, I never played that game.
That's dope.
That's what I hear. And did they do anything for Game of Thrones as well? I can't remember.
Yeah, they did an original song for Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I think Bryce Dessner also did some scoring for The Revenant.
Okay.
I don't know how much, I think it was a collaboration with somebody else, but I know he worked on that a bit too.
Yeah, so I'm always welcoming that kind of side project. It feels to me that, The National or a band have been, together and doing their thing for so long. It feels like if you can keep it fresh by exploring other outlets, creative outlets, I'm all for it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, cool. I mean, I know most of our listeners come here to get our takes on modern classical music news. So hopefully we've fulfilled that obligation this week.
Yeah, I think so.
What else have you been up to this week? Have you been listening to anything interesting besides what we're reviewing on the show today?
I'm going to pivot to another classical album.
Oh, no. What's happening to us?
No, I'm kidding. Like most of America, I guess, I've been listening to a little bit of the Black Panther soundtrack. I think it's coming out a week before the movie. It's featuring artists such as Kendrick Lamar, Vince Staples, SZA, Future, James Blake.
And yeah, you mentioned this is a Kendrick Lamar curated soundtrack. So he chose all the songs. I think he has a writing credit on every single track on the album, if I'm not mistaken.
And I think some of the tracks he's not mentioned on, you can hear him in some parts.
Yeah.
There were some parts I was like, this sounds like Kendrick, but he's not on the track, but it sounds like his vocal just on like a couple bars. But yeah, so my impressions of the soundtrack, this is without seeing the movie. I thought it was, I think it's pretty good. I mean, there's 6 or 7 songs that are really good. Like,
are we clear on whether this is actually the soundtrack to the film, or if, you know, a lot of these songs are just inspired by the film, and not actually used in the movie? I'm not really sure.
Oh,
but I would be surprised if all of these songs are somehow in the movies somewhere.
So I think maybe I might be wrong, but I think the only song on that soundtrack that's going to be used in the movie is the last song, and it's probably going to be the credits song, because there's no way Disney's approving all these
F-bombs. That's a good point. I'm pretty sure the movie's PG-13.
Yeah, and it's some of the songs are pretty political, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of analogies to our current political situation. This is a movie about a character who's a king, so there's an easy kind of tie-in to politicizing some of the lyrics. But you know, there's a few mentions of the Electoral College and stuff. So. But you know, some of the tracks that are, I think, really good. The first 3 tracks, I think, are really strong. Especially the lead single, Stars. Man, I don't know if it's because SZA's on it, but she always kind of delivers for me. And that song is probably on the radio already. But
it's definitely on the radio already. Yeah. I have to say, kind of like the last couple Kendrick albums that have come out. I mean, I've listened to this album a couple times here at home, but just leaving the house, I've heard it coming out of cars, in bars, restaurants. Yeah. So it's already weaving into the fabric of life for sure.
The other, you know, the Vince Staples song is, I think, stands out as well because it seems very unique on the album. Reminds me a little bit of what Shabazz Palace is doing in hip hop. And then I think the last song, Pray For Me With The Weeknd, is good. It sounds like straight off of Starboy from The Weeknd. Like, it sounds like they use the same beat, but it's fine. But I will say, like, the big takeaway for me from this album and why I wanted to bring it up is that this really makes me hungry for an Anderson .Paak, James Blake collab album. Like, Bloody Waters is to me the standout track on the album, and I really would like an Anderson .Paak, James Blake collaboration album. So please, if any of you parties are listening, just make it happen. Just make it happen.
Make it happen.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to quiz you if you could think of any connection between this soundtrack and an album that we reviewed last week.
What did we review last week? Hookworms and
Rye and Hookworms.
Yeah. I'm going to say there's probably a connection between Rye
and, okay.
And this, I don't know where you're going with this, so I'm just guessing here.
That track, Bloody Waters, that you mentioned, that's the Anderson .Paak, James Blake, yeah, Ab Soul collaboration, was actually co-written and produced by Robin Hannibal, who is the half of Rye before he left the group a few years ago. So he was kind of the production arm of Rye originally.
So now Robin Hannibal, his net worth is skyrocketed.
Oh, he's just cashing in. He's just cashing Kendrick and Disney checks.
Yeah, no, it was great. Good for him.
And he's done a little production for Little Dragon, and actually received co-writing credits on Bitch Don't Kill My Vibe off of Good Kid, Mad City.
Yeah, so he probably did the right thing leaving Rye.
Yeah, why not?
You know,
be on the road all the time. You can't enjoy your. I'm sure. I just imagine both guys from Rye, I imagine, live in houses with like a lot of plush white carpeting.
Yeah, I think Hannibal has a pool, though.
I'm sure he has a pool, and he's got a budget to get all those red wine stains out of the white carpet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's awesome. I didn't know that. That's a good good connection.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Anything else thinking about this week?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to just a single I've been listening to, and subsequently kind of listening to an EP and a couple tracks from the South Korean band Seisu Me, who I believe are playing South by Southwest. They have a single that seems to be getting a lot of press in the US right now after album Where We Were Together coming out in April. The single is called Old Town. Just really good vibes. I'd recommend anybody to listen to it. And I hope, you know, they catch on and we get a release, a physical release here that's not going to cost an arm and a leg to import.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're playing a few shows in Austin, so hopefully there's a tour coming. I'd love to see them. I just get really positive vibes from this band so far.
All right, yeah, I'd love to check that out.
Yeah.
For sure.
What about you? Have you been listening to anything apart from the three albums we're going to review?
Let's see. Apart from those albums, this week I've been listening to, I don't know, been going back to Bjork a lot. And her most recent album, Unison, but also I listened to Homogenic a couple times this week. This is probably my favorite full length from Bjork. Those songs are so good and sound, they sound so modern still today.
Yeah.
And then a couple things coming up that I've been checking out that we might want to talk about in the future. This new Superchunk record, What a Time to Be Alive, and this U.S. Girls album that also comes out next week. I also got my 7-inch Domino Records by this new band, Sorry, which I've been playing nonstop. You can find the tracks on Spotify and Apple Music, but they're the band that you read a lot about other bands mentioning in interviews, saying that they're the best band in London. Mm. And so they just put out these two songs that are really, really great. And I'm really looking forward to maybe a full length sometime this year. For this week, we've got a few reviews here for you. First, we're going to talk about brand new albums from early 2000s stars MGMT and Franz Ferdinand. All right?
Yeah. And we're doing this kind of all grouped into one review, right?
Yeah, I think these albums have enough in common, and their fan bases probably have a lot in common as well. So, first, I wanted to ask you, what was your connection to either MGMT or Franz Ferdinand when they were first making waves on their debut albums?
Yeah, MGMT to me put out Oracular Spectacular, kind of. To me, there was a breakout kind of classic indie album of the mid-2000s. I mean, I think it paved the way for a lot of people. I really liked it. I still do. You know, funny enough, I listened to it every so often because it's one of the only CDs I have in my car, and I can only play CDs in my car. So sometimes, you know, when I'm sick of listening to one of the three CDs I have in there, I'll put it MGMT's Oracular Spectacular. So I'm very familiar with that album, and I think it holds up. I can see why people might not like it today if they listen to it for the first time, but back in 2006, it was kind of at the height of indie rock in a way. Like, it was indie rock was peaking, and MGMT just hits that wave at the right moment with the right sound that kind of fed into all these other bands playing, you know, synth led music, in a similar way, kind of psychedelic synth indie rock in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really into it. I'll pivot now to Franz Ferdinand. Franz Ferdinand, there's rarely been a single that I've heard more take me out.
Like, it rarely when has I was a in, career been completely based on one riff.
You know, Take Me Out was, growing up in Europe, was everywhere. Like, everywhere. Like, every 30 seconds on the radio, if you switched every 30 seconds, you'd hear it on some station. And because of that, I have a distaste for that song. And I had a distaste for that song early on. And I kind of actually dismissed Franz Ferdinand. I had never really listened past their first album. And I never listened to their Sparks collaboration album. And so that was me and Franz Ferdinand. On the opposite side, MGMT, I really liked the first album. And then the second and third album, I really didn't like. And I,
so you made it all the way through. You know, when the second album, their second album came out, it was called Congratulations, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was billed as this difficult, challenging second album from MGMT. And I, you know, there was just no way I was going to listen to that. I was not, one thing I did not want in life is a difficult album from MGMT.
Right. Yeah. What was your relationship with the bands prior to today?
Well, I have to admit, this is the first MGMT album I've ever listened to all the way through. Okay. I heard those singles, Electric Feel and what's the other one? Kids. All the time, kind of like I feel like Electric Feel was almost as ubiquitous as Take Me Out, like you were talking about. Maybe it was, you know, being in college at the time, and I went to a small liberal arts school in the Northeast, and so did they. And they kind of, mm-hmm. you know, I felt like I knew exactly what was going on with those guys, and they always kind of annoyed me. And yeah. then, like, on the other hand, like, Franz Ferdinand, yeah, that song was everywhere. I quite liked their first album. I mean, listened to it a fair amount. Then similarly with them, the only other album of theirs that I ever really listened to was that Sparks collaboration that you mentioned, mm-hmm. which was their most recent release before this one. I think it's still been about 4 or 5 years now, but, this was, you know, Franz Ferdinand, Scottish band collaborating with Sparks, who are an LA based band, been around since the early 70s, and they did a collaboration and tour together. It was pretty good, but I think I'd rather just have a new Sparks album. Mm-hmm. But also, on the other hand, like, I always liked them. I thought they had a good sense of humor. I thought they were always fun. And, you know, if Franz Ferdinand showed up at the party, I wouldn't kick him out.
Right. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Why, you know, back on the MGMT thing, you know, I think you're right. There's, I'd say the first 5 songs of their first album were everywhere. You know, it's an album. I like to compare it to Hot Fuzz from The Killers in the sense that it was just as big in my mind as far as like the magnitude of that album and kind of the culture. And I also think that, you know, those first 5 songs back to back are something that they're just really good to me. But then after that, they just hit kind of a slump in the second and third. And MGMT also, one thing that I didn't really like, and I'd never seen them live, so I can't personally say, but I always heard that it was just not a very good live show.
I was going to mention the exact same thing. I had only thing I'd ever heard about them was that they were a complete train wreck live.
Yeah. I've got a few friends that saw them live in, on the Congratulations tour. And they said basically the songs that they played from Miraculous Spectacular were on, they were just singing vocals and everything was on the tape. So, really? Sounds kind of a train wreck.
Did they not have any live music? They didn't have any musicians on stage with them?
I guess they did for the new album songs, but they didn't play on the first album songs.
I see.
So
they were like, this was when they were trying to kind of be reborn as a more serious, challenging band, right?
Yeah.
So their musicians were too good to play those early songs that everybody wants to hear.
Maybe. I mean, there's plenty to like in the first album. I think, you know, it's still influential. I think people still listen to it. I think it's
Leonardo DiCaprio listens to it all the time from what I've heard.
I was trying to find a way to segue into that.
Google it.
I didn't know how, but I think there's
Thank
a lot
you later.
Of, yeah. You need to watch it. You need to Google it. This might be the episode title. but yeah, so, you know, I think it's interesting. I think also it's interesting that we're in 2018, MGMT is releasing their 4th album. Franz Ferdinand technically are releasing their 5th album, and they're kind of in a similar spot in their career.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of comparisons that could be made. And I think particularly, yeah, with this, where they are in their career and also the kind of album that they have decided to put out. I just want to say, listening, you know, it was my first time listening to an MGMT album all the way through, and my first time hearing Franz Ferdinand in quite a while. Yeah. And if both of these albums were the follow-ups to their debut, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Like, they sound right in line with, you know, their higher quality material that I've heard over their careers, I think.
I agree. I think it's, you know, when I listen to, I'm going to decouple the albums a little bit, but when I listen to the MGMT album first, or when I listen to this MGMT album, my immediate thought was like, man, I wish this was the second album. I wish there was no congratulations in whatever the third album is called. I think it's called MGMT, actually. I wish those albums didn't exist, and this was just the second album.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Because I think, you know, I enjoyed this album. It was like a natural progression. It felt like they were fully embracing their Flaming Lips love down to the producer from what I saw.
Dave Friedman.
Yeah. It also feels like kind of it's a weird album in 2018 because it feels like a French electro album in a way, but that should have come out in 2009. especially the first half of the album, like, there's a lot of like Justice/Daft Punk vibes in a way.
I noticed some interesting co-writing credits on this album as well. Ariel Pink on the third song, When You Die, is credited. And then Conan Moccasin is also credited on another song as well.
Well, that makes sense. That third song really sounds like an Ariel Pink song in a way. I really like that song. I think the sequencing is good. I was going to say, sometimes it feels like I was trying to, and maybe I shouldn't do this, but I was trying to give an analogy of what the sounds like on this MGMT album. And it's kind of like if Foxygen was produced by Daft Punk in a way. Mm-hmm. That makes any sense. Because it's kind of psychedelic and has this 70s vibe, which with like a pretty polished electro feel to it.
And a lot of bells and whistles on production, for sure. There's a lot going on in the mix on all these songs.
Yeah, I agree. I'd say that, you know, my favorite songs on the album are the first four songs, and then the one of the last songs called When You're Small.
Mm-hmm.
I quite enjoy this album. I'll probably listen to it here and there throughout the year. I don't think it's a very good album or a great album. I guess I was not expecting much, and I'm pretty pleased with this.
Yeah, I think the most common complaint about them from their fans has been that they kind of stopped writing tunes, right? They didn't, their music was, you know, the reason why people liked them to begin with was how catchy those hits were. And yeah, a lot of these songs, I mean, it wasn't a chore to listen to this album for me at all. As someone who's not really a fan of theirs, I mean, I had a good time mm-hmm. listening to it. A lot of hooks, a lot of kind of memorable choruses, and I mean, it's just fun. And I think if their fans from the beginning who kind of lost track with them were to just dial in right now, they'd probably really like this album a lot.
Yeah, I agree. Return to form, but I think that's the best way to put it, is that if you're a fan, I don't think you'll be disappointed.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to get caught in your head on this album. So yeah, I think I give it a recommendation, especially if you are you know, or ever were a fan, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you think about the Franz record?
It's kind of meh to me.
Kind of meh.
Yeah. There's some good moments, but overall I didn't really have a good time or found it interesting. I found it pretty shallow.
You mentioned French disco and
yeah, Philippe Starck.
Yeah, the producer, he was half of the synth pop duo Cassius.
Yeah, and
he's worked with Phoenix a lot too, right?
Right. I think he produced Wolfgang Amadeus, that breakout album from Phoenix. You know, and back to the production, like immediately on the first song, you're like, oh, okay, right, here it is. You can definitely hear that influence. I'm going to talk about what I like shortly, and probably just a couple of songs. I like Lazy Boy, that second song. I think it's a good song. Mm-hmm. I like Academy Award.
It's a single now too.
Yeah. I like the Academy Award. It has a very kind of pulp vibe to me. I kind of like it.
The Academy Award for romance goes to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the last song, Slow, Don't Kill Me Slow.
Yeah. I quite like the last couple songs are probably the highlight of the album for me.
I'll tell you which song I really don't like. And I really dislike it. Huck and Jim.
I wanted to say at the same time as you, that song is horrible.
It is so bad. And
drinking 40s with Huck and Jim.
Oh, it's so bad. And it's almost insulting. And the other piece that, you know, I think that song really makes me dislike the album, but there's a vibe 3 or 4 times I get into the album. And I think it's back to your first comment about Take Me Out, about a band that's been so defined by one single riff. I sometimes catch myself hearing that riff or hearing that guitar tone in that same beat. And I'm like, and I half expect them to go into Take Me Out. And I feel like they struck gold once and they don't know how to get away from it. Yeah. And so when I hear that, I talked about my dislike for that song. I just can't. And unfortunately, my first listen of the album, I didn't want to keep going after 3 or 4 songs. I wanted to stop. And then I've re-listened to it, 3 or 4 times now. And that's where I came around to a couple of these songs and kind of try to be a little more impartial. But I'd give it a pass,
Yeah, I think I'm a little higher on it than you are, but it's definitely not an essential work at all. And I think I had so checked out with them. I didn't even hear their last album before this, Without Sparks. And so I kind of, I was kind of surprised that I thought the songwriting for the most part, aside from Huck and Jim, which is one of the worst songs I've heard in a long time. It kind of holds up to their quality, their standards on their first album. I mean, of course, there's nothing like Take Me Out on here. They departed with their guitar player before making this album and have two new members, another guitarist and person who's listed as a producer. I'm not sure exactly what they do live, but I think they are a part of the live band. So there is a little change up personnel-wise. I wouldn't really notice it on any of the songs. I think it's still mostly the vision of Alex Kapranos, the lead singer and guitar player. This is a very eager to please album. I think it's like you go out with somebody and they're constantly asking you if you're having a good time, trying to check in, trying to make sure that you're having fun all the time. And it's kind of like winking and a little bit desperate to please at times.
I totally agree.
Depends on if you're charmed by that at all or not. It kind of like, it's in your face. Here I am. We're having a great time. These are fun songs, right? This is a catchy little riff right here, right? All the time. And it's, it doesn't really feel organic. It doesn't feel like it's coming from a necessarily a very genuine place.
I agree. I think, when I was listening to it yesterday, one thought that popped into my head is that it sounds like they wrote 10 songs and they wanted 8 of them to be singles on the radio. And
and
they fell on all of them because they kind of just as you said, they try to please on too many songs and they don't really have a point of view. It feels really safe. Like, And that was another thing, you know, that I like about the comparison between MGMT and then Franz Ferdinand is they had huge albums, huge first albums. They probably had nothing to lose then, which allowed them to be kind of free in their writing. But it feels, especially on the Franz album, that they have a lot to lose. So they kind of just scutter on like that middle line of, you know, we're not going to make a statement, really. We're just going to make something that kind of pleases a lot of people. See, the things that you do are not who you are. Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over? Think I'm a friend. And wish them love. Think I'm an enemy.
I think Franz is kind of skirting on the same level. They had another, I mean, Know You Girls, which I think was on their third album, was a pretty big radio hit. At least they played a lot on K-Rock in L.A. So I think they've had, you know, a little bit more ups and downs as opposed to MGMT. But I think it's a good time to check in with these albums. You might be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think Always Ascending and Lazy Boy, the first two tracks, will get radio play. But I don't think that it makes that a good album. I don't think Always Ascending is a very good track. But it uses that Franz Ferdinand formula in a way where it's like the song starts at one thing and it becomes something totally different, which was kind of what Take Me Out in a Nutshell was. And yeah. Always Ascending does that. Huck and Jim does it like six times, which is like, fuck, man, I can't even with that song. And like the lyrics are insulting. It's not even
the lyrics
funny.
Are pretty insulting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was hoping you'd bring that song up because I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to talk about it. But I think if you want to hear a train wreck of a song, that's a good one to dial up.
Yeah. Another thought I had around this album, and then we can let this one rest. You know, on the QTY album, I talked about, I really, really like the album, but there's a couple songs that feel phoned in, and I mentioned two. And that was okay. This one feels to me like there's five or six songs that are phoned in, but in the way that, like, again, it's a successful band that is doing it, I don't know, it just reminds me of, like, Coldplay in a way, like, but bad Coldplay. And not in the sound, but in the way, like, it's very formulaic and, like, here's the song about this. Here's the hook about this. Remember this? Remember we used to do this? Here it is. Like, I don't know.
Whereas Echo on the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club album was an example of a good Coldplay song.
Right, right.
You always got to be careful with your good Coldplay and your bad Coldplay.
Yeah, it's an easy line to blur.
it really is. It's so close.
Exactly. And then the last thing, I guess I'll say one more thing, is I actually was looking forward to this album because I hadn't been exposed to too much. And I thought, you know what? It's been 12 or 13 years or whatever, 14 years since the first album. I should really give these guys another chance. Boy, was I wrong.
Well, that's pretty much exactly the way I felt about the MGMT album. Like, I would give these guys another chance. And I felt, you know, fine with it.
Yeah,
it definitely surpassed my expectations.
Yeah, I agree. And God, Huck and Jim, man.
Huck and Jim. All right, we're gonna leave it there. Let us know if you get a chance to check out any of those early 2000s darlings making their comebacks here in 2018. We're going to move on to an act that I think is poised to do big things this year. This is an album called Transangelic Exodus by Ezra Furman. This is Ezra Furman's second solo album, although he's been around now for, I think, put out his first full length in 2007, so a little over 10 years, releasing three albums with Ezra Furman and the Harpoons, and then two albums with Ezra Furman and the Boyfriends. He kind of comes from a garage rock 50s sensibility. There's a lot of homages to early rock music in the music and the songs that he writes. But he's taking a little bit of a left turn with this newest release. Had you been familiar with any of his oeuvre before now, Nick?
Not at all. I have to say I wasn't familiar with his work before this at all.
He's a Chicago bred songwriter, but put out an album, Day of the Dog, in 2013 with Ezra Furman and the Boyfriends that started to get quite a bit of attention in the UK. And at this point, he has quite a large following over there, but it's still growing here in the States. So what was your impression of this album going into it, not really knowing anything about who the songwriter was? And, did you have any impressions of it before you press play for the first time?
No, I mean, I went in completely blind. I looked up on Wikipedia how many albums he'd done, you know, back to your prior comments. I saw he was fairly prolific, whether it was in his solo work or some of the work he's done with other bands. And it was an interesting comparison to me because, you know, we're talking about, a singer-songwriter that is fairly prolific, and we just talked about two bands that have put four or five albums out. And he's put out more albums, but my first impression was, like, he is going for it. Like, where Franz Ferdinand, especially a little bit MGMT, but Franz Ferdinand especially feels really safe. You know, Ezra Furman's album feels really raw and, like, you know, full of emotion and really interesting. This is at the first glance. And then I think the album itself has a depth that, you know, it feels very ambitious.
Yeah, very ambitious, I would say.
Whether it succeeds on the ambition, I don't know, but I think it's worthy of a very serious listen. They're not going to be all radio hits, but you don't have to make radio hits, I think, to make a very interesting work. And I believe this is a concept album, right?
It's a concept album. I've read quite a bit about it. I don't know. I always have trouble with concept albums. I never really grasp the narrative while I'm listening to them, at least for most. But the title Transangelic Exodus is in this world that he's created. He's called it part fiction, part memoir, but there's trans angels that are ostracized in society. These are people that are transitioning from human to angel and are, you know, want to come out and spread their wings. Mm-hmm. And it's a story about him falling in love with a trans angel and being on the run from the cops.
Yeah. And I thought there's definitely, you know, obviously parallels to modern society, which I thought made it even more interesting. I think, you know, it's interesting. About a year ago, we probably thought, you know, with our political climate or whatever's going on in the world, one of the, I guess, good things they will have probably get great art from it. And I think in 2018, we're starting to, or even like 2017, we're starting to see some of that. And I think that this is an example of that. I think, and it's not on the nose. It's kind of a contemplation of our state in a way where, you know, these are trans angels that are, you know, ostracized, you said. And people think, I believe, that people are panic because they believe their condition is contagious and it should be outlawed. So, I mean, definitely some parallels there. So with that context, you know, I think it's really, really, really good. And I think every song is interesting. And, you know, I'm kind of like you with concept albums, but this one really reads to me like, you know, you mentioned The National during the soundtrack to Cyrano de Bergerac, but this feels like an album that should be accompanied with like a play or like a soundtrack. It feels like almost like a soundtrack to a movie. And it, I don't know, it really plays like one.
Yeah, I would. One thing I thought about the concept of this is that I would actually like to see a movie based on this. It sounds pretty, yeah. I mean, it sounds pretty fun. And the energy, thinking about it as like a road narrative, or like more of like being an on the run, a chase, the music is so urgent. Mm-hmm. Even when the songs hit ballad territory, they feel very urgent. Like they, yeah. He's got so much to say on this record, and you know, it just gets it out so fast. There's one love, and I know no other. It's the love of I'm bound to drive me faster. I don't mind, I gladly pay that highway fine. This little heart is open wide, and it's getting.
Yeah.
I'd say some, you know, there's a lot of musical kind of homages on this album. There's a lot of familiar territory that is being brought in and used in a different way. Like I said before, earlier on in his output, there, you know, was a lot of kind of early rock and roll, 50s, 60s, Chuck Berry inspired music. And now he's moved into like a lot of Lou Reed territory. There's a song on here that is basically a ripoff of Hey, Hey, My, My by Neil Young, I think on purpose. Usually when you have those kind of overt references like that, it turns me off a little bit because I get too reminded of an original artist and I just want to go back and listen to them. But there's something new about the way he's using these influences on this album. He said something like, I saw a quote by him recently where, you know, he was so interested in early rock and roll and of course Bob Dylan and Lou Reed, but then he's like, how can I make an early rock and roll album after I've heard Yeezus? Mm. And there's a real edge to the songs, and especially the production on here, that gives it a completely unique sound, and it doesn't have me just going back and thinking about all the things that he's referencing.
Yeah, it's very interesting you said that. When I was listening to it, one of my first impressions was that it felt almost like if Springsteen was Ezra's age, this would be the kind of album he would put out.
Like, yeah, that first track, Suck the Blood from My Wounds, is very close to Born to Run by Springsteen. Exactly. I mean, I think that's on purpose too. And it's like a way to tell you what he's reaching for here on this album.
Yeah. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think like, it's like a very good example of a contemporary take on Americana. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good. Plus on this album is that, as opposed to the Franz Ferdinand album, which feels like it drags on forever, this one actually just goes by in a flash. It's a really enjoyable listen. You know, it's pretty deep, but I don't know. It just kind of flies by. Those long afternoons when nobody was home but me. Sun is shining, but I dwell in shadow. Maraschino red dress, $8.99 at Goodwill. I was looking over my shoulder at the register, trying not to be seen, looking over my shoulder at all.
Yeah, I found it to be pretty intense. Like, and the first time I listened to it, there was a few songs that really stood out to me.
Which one were those?
The first time I listened to it, definitely Suck the Blood from My Wounds,
yeah.
Driving Down to LA, and then the last song on the album, I Lost My Innocence. Mm-hmm. You know, all those songs really stood out to me. But the more I've listened to it, I could pretty much put on any track on this album and be excited about it.
Yeah. Right?
And they've all left an impression on me in a way that I wasn't expecting the first time I heard it. It really, I mean, it's got an immediacy to it and that urgency that I mentioned, but also the depth and lyrically, it's really all over the place. And, you know, Ezra is devoutly Jewish and, mm-hmm. you know, writes about that. He refers to himself as queer and gender nonconforming. And when he performs live, he usually is wearing lipstick and wearing a dress. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and it doesn't feel like an affect at all. It feels like a very natural part of who he is as a performer and in his writing. And you can tell that he approaches this. He's a writer, and there's a novelistic feeling to this album to me, meaning that it's expansive and there's a lot of little boxes to unpack here and there. So I'm still finding myself, I think I've probably listened to the whole thing 7 or 8 times, and I'm still going to spend a lot more time with it because there's a lot of things that I'm still discovering.
Yeah. I think, you know, your comments on him being a writer is exactly why it feels like a soundtrack to which we want to see the movie. You know, it's very, the storytelling is really good. You know, it's engrossing. And I agree with you. I also think like the sequencing is really good. Like, and that's why it feels like a play or musical in a way. Like, you'll have these really high moments and then you have a slower song, but that's introspective, or there's then another song that feels like this is the bad guy moment. Like, it's engrossing, you know. I'll mention a couple of tracks that stood out to me. I think the first two tracks you mentioned, Suck the Blood from My Wound and Drive Down to LA, are really good. I really like No Place. I find myself actually starting the album at No Place very often. Like, I'll just put No Place on and then let it roll from there. And I like the 9th track, Love You So Bad.
Yeah, that's a really good song.
I Lost My Innocence, of course, is a great track.
I Lost My Innocence to a Boy Named Vincent.
Yeah.
He makes it work.
Yeah, it's really good. I would recommend, you know, people listen to this pretty and give it a lot of time. You know, it's worthy of several listens.
I hadn't really thought about it in terms of the political climate about, you know, more good art being produced, but as we have seen from talking about records from the beginning of 2018, I mean, we've had about every week something really good come out.
I agree. I think this is an outpouring of people's feelings and I guess it's a good thing.
Yeah.
In that sense.
And I mean, this is this album. If you're interested in rock albums at all, this is something that I think you're going to like.
What is, I had meant to ask you this. What is your history with concept albums?
I mean, there's two kind of concept albums, right? There's a concept album that has a story and some kind of narrative, and there might be something tied into it, whether it's a film or a piece of writing or a video game even. Mm-hmm. And then there's a concept album that is thematic. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite albums of all time is The Holy Bible by Manic Street Preachers, which I think you could say is thematically a concept album, and the songs are all pulled together by similar themes and a feeling and an emotion, but has no storyline. Yeah. And I think I'm more drawn to albums that, you know, don't have a narrative linking them through. Cause usually it's something pretty stupid or, you know, something that's so hard to grasp that I kind of am left cold by it. So usually when somebody says concept album, I am a little turned off by it. I don't think that I can't think of many successful ones, I guess.
Right.
Do you have any favorites?
No, I mean, I think a lot of people have issues with concept albums because very often I believe they fail. And I think it's a hard exercise. So I just think this is really good.
The one I always think of, and I think maybe the most commonly considered concept album, is probably The Wall by Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And I remember watching the movie as a kid and just being like, what is this? Like, I know. This is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. I don't know. What are they so upset about? There's a wall. I mean, maybe I think, and now I think I probably am too old to go back and look at that and find anything useful in it. But I don't know. Some of those Kinks albums, like Village Green Preservation Society, I think a lot of people consider that a concept album. I don't know really what the story is, but the songs are great. So I think you could sometimes just, you know, forget about the overlying narrative. I mean, I think with this Ezra Furman album, the concept is not going to be something that I remember. It's going to be individual songs and the whole feeling that the album gives me.
And I think that's the best concept albums, is when they succeed. Is like for this one, I had no idea it was one, or I had no idea that, I guess I had no idea it was one, and I listened to it and I really liked it. And then once you discover kind of the intent behind it, it added another piece to another level to it. And the
songs, I think if you're already familiar with the songs, that makes a lot of sense. Cause then you're like, there's some place where these are coming from. But don't you think it's kind of a way for an artist to say, okay, I have this story, and a way for them to get inspired to write the songs? Or do you think it works in the opposite way, where they have the songs and then put the concept together? They realize that there was a common thread running through the songs that they were writing.
That's tough, because my initial feeling is that you should start with the concept. And because I think like bad concept albums probably have been the opposite in most ways, where they kind of thought there was a similar feeling and they said, oh, this is a concept album about X. And then as a listener, you don't really grasp it, because maybe that thread was a little too, like, you had to be part of the band to see it. I don't know. As soon as you declare it being a concept album, you're almost like, you're putting yourself out there, because people are immediately looking for it. And so if you can't find it or you don't get it, you immediately think it fails. But with this one, like, again, the songs stand out on their own, and the concept or the story or the intent is just another layer behind it. And it just makes it that much more interesting. You start thinking about, oh, this is why this song is at this place. It's like number four, you know, this is why we're talking about this now. Oh, I see the story, you know, maybe things you wouldn't have thought of had you not known.
Yeah. I think, you know, this can all sound like homework, like you're going to have to work really hard, but with this record, the Ezra Furman album, it's not like that at all.
Yeah.
Easy to kind of dive in and get taken away by the actual songs themselves.
I agree.
All right. Well, that was our review of Transangelic Exodus. I think an album that caught us both by surprise this week, and we'll keep listening to it. Love to hear what you guys think about it. Thanks for subscribing, following, 5-star reviews. You know, we can't get enough of those 5-star reviews.
Yeah. Keep them coming.
And we got some exciting things coming up for you guys in the next few weeks, which you'll learn about soon. Some really good stuff coming up, so keep a lookout.
Sounds good.
All right. Talk to you later, Nick.
See you, Hunter.